I guess the first question that I would want to ask you is one about leadership.
Yes.
Your view, perspective, belief on what the number one role or task of a leader is within an organization or a grouping or whatever it is. What do you think is that core thing that any leader always needs to make sure that they achieve in their leadership?
My view is firstly to thoroughly understand the purpose of the organization which they lead. Once they thoroughly understand the purpose, they can better communicate it to the people who need to comparably understand it. And when they formulate their team, which is going to ensure that that purpose is achieved, is going to be based on a thorough understanding of the purpose. If the purpose is misunderstood, then the rest is lost.
That's a good one.
In a sense, if we look at this, the president of the country, one president would be saying, we do exist because we were created to exist. But what is it that can distinguish us to make sure that we are a winning nation? My view, very few presidents apply their minds on that. The CEO, in a similar fashion, the CEO of the Chamber of Mines, I need to be saying, other than the tradition which has been established, other than whatever I may have inherited, why does the chamber exist really? And the better that picture is clear in my mind, the better I'm going to perform the rest of my time.
That's quite profound, actually, because it actually reminds me of Stephen Covey, where he talks about he uses this metaphor of a ladder, but you could put a ladder against the wall and do your best to climb it, but if you realize later on that it's leaning against the wrong wall, all of that effort was wasted, which is basically what you've really just said.
I agree, and it links somehow as well with Stephen Covey's one of his effectiveness issues of begin with an end in mind, because the purpose is the end. If you begin with that in mind and say this is being done for that end, and it becomes clearer.
That's really great. And the theme of the book, which is also the title of the book, The Best Advice I Ever Got,
you know,
which really is the reason why I'm doing all of this, because I want to hear what that is. And I know that almost everyone I've interviewed that always say, I've gotten a lot of advice along the way. And I know, and I'm very respectful of that. But there's always one or two things that stand out for a lot of us. And I guess that's the question I'm going to ask you now, that in your life, in your story and your journey, what would you say is that advice that has kind of guided you over many, many years in your life and in business, in your career?
It was given to me by one of my first mentor coach, Mr. Anthony Hill, who said, Gregi, work hard and be goal-focused and smart intermittently. In a sense, therefore, is to say, I need to focus on the goals, work hard. If I can be smart, let me work smart. But I think it has got to be hard work, goal focused, and smart intermittent.
Wow. And at then, I mean, this kind of advice, the way I see it, it's not one of those where you would remember it when you are in a situation. It's almost like it becomes a way of life.
Yes.
And I don't know if this question is appropriate in this kind of advice, but what I would like to understand from you is whether there are instances that you can recall right now where you know, in the middle of a task or of a project or of a situation where you stopped and said, hey, I'm glad I got that advice because it has really served me. Had I not had it, I wouldn't have gotten through this particular situation. Is there something that comes to mind of that nature?
I think there are quite a few one can think about, but I think what is really foremost in my mind is my biggest contribution in my career really happened in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
I was seconded to the Independent Electoral Commission and KwaZulu-Natal as an election monitor. And as I was monitoring the elections, there was violence and whatever, the crisis happened in the counting center, where for about 3 days, we would struggle to have more than 4 hours of sleep. And we were working almost around the clock. And the reason was, it was, I think, one of the number two or number three biggest counting stations in the country.
Wow.
And the results, people were watching the results across the nation, but particularly in KwaZulu-Natal. And it was the biggest counting station in KwaZulu-Natal. It had a crisis that you had to solve.
Hmm.
And so when there, one was working is to say, you know what, there is no bad work here. Those ballots have got to be counted. You need to just ensure that people are deployed appropriately, and you need to be there. You are a stopgap, and therefore you are inheriting the team which you are taking from a crisis, and they don't know you for a bar of soap. They have no loyalty to you. You need to be saying, this is what we need to be doing. And you know what, guys, if we hurt each other in the process, sorry, once we have finished the process, we're going to say, let's be comradery about this thing and let's resolve whatever queries. But so long as we need to count, we have a deadline to meet in that.
Wow. And right now, I mean, you mentioned your mentor who gave you the advice that you just told me. If you would be called upon to give advice to a younger generation of leaders, future leaders, if you like, what would that be? Especially reflecting on your own life and the things that you now know, you, especially those you now know for sure, if there is such a thing, what advice would you give to younger people who aspire to be greater leaders in the future?
Well, I would hold to the same one I received, that hard work is no substitute for hard work, and because somebody has got to work hard. But a comparable one, because we are living in such a conflict-ridden situation. Somebody said to me, Peggy, always have strong friends and weak enemies. If those who are strong cannot be your friends, at least let them be neutral about you. The most deadly thing you can do is to have strong enemies and weak friends. Because when that happens, you're dead.
That's very good advice, really.
Which unfortunately, though, periodically one forgets the good advice, and you do what they say, experience is that which you get moments after it's needed it. Sometimes you think, wow, I didn't follow the advice I had received.
That is true.
Yes.
You know, and it's interesting because a big part of my work is speaking.
Yes.
You know, so and as a speaker, you always sound like you know everything. And sometimes I catch myself talking to my audience and I'll be making a mental note saying, gee, I should use that advice. What I just told these people is actually something that I should try in my own
life. Apply it in my
life. Exactly. So I agree with what you say.
Yeah.
We live in a very interesting time. Everybody's talking about the environment. Everybody's talking about caring about the world and humanity and everything around us. From a leader's perspective, why would you say it's important for corporate leaders to think beyond profits and shareholders and think about the world we live in, the environment, and about social responsibility in general?
People are the highest things that God ever created. Everything else is less important. Money included. And therefore, if we are going to be so money-focused, if we look at materially, we'll find that we fail to treasure, to celebrate, to affirm and honor the pinnacle of God's creation, which is human beings. And that's why one needs to care. There are some deep thinkers who say, people generally don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so the more you care, the more they are going to reciprocate your caring. And they will reciprocate it by doing those things you care about most. Therefore, if you build a team, people need to know that you care for them as people, not just as Canon Fodder as it were, but as people with their unique peculiarities or idiosyncrasies. But so long as you care about them, they are going to care about you and what you stand for. And my view, therefore, it's not a functional caring. I'm going to care for you so that you work for me. I care for you because you matter. And having done that, the task matters too. Let's deal with the task.
In every business, one of the things that I would say is kind of universal across all businesses is what I guess it can be loosely defined as a customer or a client, where you hear business leaders saying, well, you know, we put our customers at the core of what we do, or as Raymond Ackerman would say, four legs off the table, and we put the customer right on top. Looking in your environment and the work that you do, who would you say is the customer that you serve, for instance, as the Chamber of Mines, and how do you ensure that your customer in that environment gets the best customer experience?
My customer is the 54 or 64 members of the Chamber. Those are our customers, because they are the recipients of our service, and so we do the best we can to protect and promote their interests. They fund the Chamber. Without them, the Chamber's resources would run dry. So they are our members. How do we ensure that they get the best customer service? It's firstly to engage with them, because the customer is the chief definer of what they want. So engage with them intensely and continuously, so that we continue to refine our understanding as to what they want, whether our performance is meeting their expectations on an ongoing basis. And the second one, I think, is to build the team. To say, now understanding what the customer wants, let me build the delivery team so that they deliver or minister to the customer expectation.
What would you say? I mean, you've done a lot of different things over the years. You've played different roles. I remember when I first met you, that story that I told you, when I first saw you in Cape Town, you were playing a different role to the roles that you play now. What would you say is, among other things, is the one thing that has kind of guided and informed some of the choices that you've been making for your life in terms of the work that you choose to do with your life? And to add to that question, looking further down the line, how would you say you'd like to be remembered, your legacy, about 100 years from today? We talk about people like Einstein, they died like so many years ago, but we still talk about them today. What would you like your legacy to be, and what also informs your decisions for your work right now?
I think I tend to wish to calibrate my sense of justice and say, what is the right and the just thing to do under this current circumstance? And then master sufficient courage to do it. And oftentimes, disregarding some consequences that may happen to myself in the short term. And therefore, I would wish to be remembered as a diligent, courageous, transformational leader. For me to say, I was diligent in that I did what needs to be done. I was courageous in that I would take some brave, bold steps. But to say, let's transform South Africa from how good it is to be better. Because I think for us really we're faced with a typical good to great issue. If we are not leaving whatever institution, if we don't leave the country great when we found it good, then we will have failed. Didn't we say, good to great has got to be my guiding principle to say, was there a discernible difference in what he did? Was that a positive discernible difference? That's what I would say.
Wow. I guess that kind of ties in with the next question that I have. The way I'm structuring this book, I've kind of broken it into three parts.
Mm.
The first part is where all the featured leaders answer the one question, the best advice I ever got.
Yeah.
Especially for those lazy readers who say, I just want to, you know, get the summarized version of what's the best advice they ever got. So that would be the first part, which would be just a page for each leader. The middle section of the book is where the rest of these questions that I'm asking you would come in with a bit of analysis from me.
Mm.
Hopefully I'll do justice to all the wisdom I'm getting.
Yes.
And thirdly, the last part of the book, I call it Just One More Thing. Now that you've read the rest of the book, you have just one more thing to think about going forward. And the question that I'm going to ask features in that area.
Mm.
And this question focuses on three things.
Mm.
The question is, what is the one thing among everything else and in addition to what we are currently doing, but what is the one thing that in your view you think we can do as a country to boost our economy, I guess the good to great situation that you just mentioned? How do we become better, especially from an economic perspective? What is the one thing that we can, in your view, that you think we can do over and above what we're talking about, what we're trying to do and what we're already doing?
I would say the one thing is a genuine government business union partnership. When you look at that golden triangle, if the president of the country, if the cabinet were to say, this is the golden triangle, we are the government and therefore we represent the community. I don't talk to the community in the triangle. We as the government represent the community. Here is labor. It's representing those who are employed. Here is government. They are representing capital as it were, or the enterprise. Let's have as effective as a partnership as possible. And therefore, if there is a problem, we need to say, let the three put their heads together and say, until we come with a solution which satisfies the needs of each of the three appropriately, let's continue being locked into the room. Because I think if we were to do that, the communities would be beneficial.
Mm.
However, at the moment, where the quality of that golden triangle, my view is, not that great.
Hmm. That's quite an insightful point, because I've heard a lot about partnership between, like people I've already spoken to, between government and business.
Yes.
You know, almost everybody has said that. But the triangle, the golden triangle that you spoke of, I think it just makes sense. You know, it really does. And would you say there's a, I'm now digressing from, because this was supposed to be one thing. But would you say there's a, obviously there's a challenge with, within that triangle right now.
Mm-hmm.
And would you say is it because of mistrust among these three parties?
Yes. I think it is mistrust mixed with a scarcity mentality. A scarcity mentality which says, what if I give, you take, and there is less for me? As opposed to the abundance mentality which says, if this golden triangle happens well, what I give is a seed to you, which is going to come as a fruit to all of us. That, in my view, is a challenge. And therefore, the union is going to want as much as possible. The government is going to want as much as possible. Business is going to want as much as possible. Instead of saying, you know what, let's invest in this relationship. People are saying, how much can I take out of the relationship? And it requires the maturity of leadership, which is saying, as you are going to be seeing your girlfriend, about 3 months ago, 3 months ago? Yes, we were celebrating our 20th anniversary. And the person who was preaching to us, he said, in a marriage is an act of self-donation. At some stage you say, I, Betty Spear, donate myself to you, Tembi Spear, and hopefully you reciprocate. Because in that self-donation, then you say, me no longer matter, you do, as the rest of the world. I think if we were to have that kind of a thinking amongst the leaders who are saying, how can I know you love Steve Covey, and let me love, say I love Stephen Covey. He says, seek first to understand, then be understood. If business were to say, there are idiosyncrasies of the government, let's understand those. What are they? There are idiosyncrasies of labor. Let's understand them thoroughly. Hopefully they are going to reciprocate. And once we thoroughly understand where we come from, and that we are all loyal to this country, South Africa, it's just that our expression of loyalty is different. It would improve trust levels. And the rest will follow.
That is so true.
I'm working in the industry where accidents, mine accidents, and fatalities are high. Unacceptably high. And then you deal with labor who says you don't care about human lives. You deal with the government who says you don't care about human lives. And then I say, there are some CEOs who cry, shed tears because there has been a fatality in the mine. People would say, they're lying. But that's how deeply they feel about the fatality. However, it is not seen or appreciated by others, and therefore it is. You are deriving blood profit. You're deriving profit at the expense of human life. When people mourn each time they have a fatality. And so I think for us, the issue of the golden triangle, it's easier spoken about than experienced. In a similar fashion, the issue of self-donation to your partner is easy to talk about than when the reality hits the ground.
That's interesting. That's kind of
an
insightful
point. I can see that it is to be shown by saying, if I commit to hell, I'm going to donate myself. But then in a religious sense, a spiritual sense, you start coming to God and you say, there is nothing, God, I can give you. All I can give you is my unqualified loyalty. Because I am yours. And if I give you my unqualified loyalty, and that is the best I can give you.
That is true. You know, it's interesting on that point you just made. I remember a story, there's a book I read by a guy called Mike Harris. He's an entrepreneur, British entrepreneur. He tells a story where this one year he was invited to one of Bill Gates' parties, where he invites all the CEOs of their partner company. And he says he was sitting next to Warren Buffett, you know, during this dinner. And Warren asked him, so how are you married? And Mike Harris said, yeah. I've been married for 30 years. So Warren Buffett laughed and said, wow, you must have found the secret to lasting relationships. And then Mike was like, well, I don't know. What is it? So Warren Buffett laughed and walked away because he's such a big joker. And then a couple of minutes later, he came back and he whispered on his ear. He said, the secret to lasting relationships is low expectations.
Mm.
If you don't expect too much from your partner, chances
that
are...
That is so true.
I thought that was quite interesting. I was like, okay. Okay. Again, the second question of the Just One Thing is the question of rural development.
Mm.
And this came about to me because I was looking around and I'm thinking, Africa as a whole, including South Africa, we're such a rural continent.
Mm.
And here in South Africa, we talk a lot about rural development, but what does that mean? And is there, do we even think about a competitive advantage that we may have as a result of the rural our ruralness, or what does all of this mean to us? So what is the one thing in your view, again, in the same line as the first question, that we need to think about or that we need to do to improve what we call rural development?
I'd say infrastructure is one word.
Uh-huh.
You improve the roads to the rural areas. You improve the access to the markets. You improve the electricity or even the cellular reception. You encourage people to stay there.
Mm.
You improve electricity access. You encourage the raising of the quality of life there. And you may find that those three, and well, let's look at water, is the fourth one. You may find that water being available, roads being available, telephone, electricity, quite a lot of urban people would like to try to reverse, go to the rural areas and enjoy the quality of life. Because the quality of life in the rural area, other than the glitter and glamour, is higher. My view is infrastructure. Because even security, there's better security in rural areas than in urban areas. But the police are less in the rural areas, but there's more security. And then it's just saying, do police bring us security? They don't.
Oh, that's a big question. That is a big question.
They don't. They calm our nerves, and they are present, but they don't. For us, what reduces security is we are too much in each other's space. In the rural areas, is the expanse. Few people are in each other's space. So infrastructure.
Wow. And my last one, I'm just talking. It's a big question that I have about Africa. Because I'm looking at the world now, the focus on emerging markets and the interest from the so-called developed economies and the big banks of the world, the interest that everybody seems to be paying on emerging markets and the growth that we've seen, I mean, in countries like China and India, who are now our friends in South Africa and I think of Africa. And the question that I ask myself, especially in light of our history and the continent of Africa, I say, what's going to be different this time? And the cost? We were colonized, the continent was stripped, you know, of all its wealth, maybe not all, but a big chunk of its wealth left this place. And in terms of the roads or all the logistical infrastructure was leading outside of the African continent. It's very difficult to travel within Africa, but it's easier to move from one country in Africa to Europe and vice versa. Now, what's going to be different now, or what is it that we can do, or that we need to think about as African leaders, in business, in government, in unions, like that golden triangle? What is the one thing that we need to watch out for to ensure that the history doesn't repeat itself now that everybody's looking at us again and trying to be our friend at this time when there's so much rush into emerging markets?
I think with all the issues we are raising, I think in my view, they amount to one thing, which I could look at as a coin, which is double-sided. One is actual pessimism. For us, that's what actually colonization caused us to be optimistic about. And if you were to look at it as turning it around, if we could actually be just proud of being prosperous and truly be Africans. I think it was Hope Bunyee who once said they wanted us to be a carbon copy of the French people. And the fact that you and I here are talking to each other in English, when we could talk to each other in an African language, possibly Zulu, Xhosa, a bit of Swati, it we have been that colonized. A good holiday for me and my family may end up in London, whereas an effective holiday may be me being somewhere in Kenya, Maasai Mara. However, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to go to a place which is more elegant. And so for us, I think, in terms of being proud of being African and not disparaging one another, you are a Zimbabwean, South African, you are DRC. We were stripped of a lot of our resources, but if you were to look at the continents, all six continents, and you say mineral resources, Africa is by far the most mineral rich continent in the world. By far. How would I argue that? South Africa is by far South Africa. $2.5 trillion US dollars worth of minerals. The closest to us is Russia at 1.5. The closest to Russia is Australia at 1. And the rest. Now we are 1 in 53. And you go to DRC. The mineral resources in DRC are huge. You go to Zimbabwe. You know the best platinum mine in Africa is in Zimbabwe. Better than South Africa. And now I've just spoken about three. The diamonds. When you want diamonds, go to Botswana. It's Botswana which is done. And of course, you have a number. And therefore, when you look at the numbers, here, though, is our African leader. In terms of them, we could actually say, let's focus on four industries. Mining, because they are here. And if you want to get them, you have to be here. My view is agriculture, ruralness, because they are saying the next third world war may be over water. And you know what? If it is not water, it's over food. They may produce it artificially. For us as a country, we are a water-scarce country. Let's go to Zimbabwe. Go to Malawi. Go to Zambia, go to Uganda, go to Kenya, go to DRC. Water is water for the world, not for Africa, for the world. You talk about the mighty Congo. Mighty Congo at Kinshasa, which is 350 kilos inland, is at least a kilometer wide. At least a kilometer wide, deep. And when you talk about Inga Falls, I'm not so sure whether Inga Falls probably they may be second biggest because there is one which is interaction. So for us, when you say agriculture, and then you look at tourism. When we talk about the big five, there is no continent in the world which rivals Africa. None.
Wow.
And you talk about renewables. There is no continent in the world which is as sunny as Africa. None. And now when you talk about solar energy, if you really were to be serious about solar energy, this is the continent.
Wow.
However, you are going to find that we are going to be fighting like frogs, which are shouting like crazy. Who is the biggest of them? Because they are shouting instead of saying, let's focus.
Mm-hmm.
And you get other countries, they are focusing. You hear China, their plan, vision, 2030. I have not read it. I want to read it.
Mm-hmm.
But their forecast, these are the things that we're going to do. And China is going to rule the world by 2030.
Wow.
America notwithstanding,
mm-hmm.
going to rule the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are really focused on vision. For us, unfortunately, we are 53 countries in the continent of just about 1 billion people. For China, it's one country with now close to 1.5 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they are bigger than us, and the vision is one for the country. And that's why Thabo Mbeki, with all his failings and frailties, when he came up with African vision, he said, I am an African. I think for us, unfortunately, we dragged him so much instead of saying, you know what, you have done what you need to do. Let's appropriately manage you to the African Union. Because had Thabo been driving the African Union, my view, the continent would change for significantly better. But he was trapped in the mud of the ANC, and the rest is that history.
Wow. Gee, that was quite a lesson on Africa you just gave. Because I really didn't know. I mean, all of these things, and as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, do Africans know this? You know what I mean? Like, I'm especially people who are sitting in positions where they could influence. You know what I mean? Where they are trusted by those they lead. You know what I mean? To make it a difference and to pull us all forward. You know, it's a big question, I guess, for another discussion about leadership in Africa.
Certainly, because I think if I were to add to, there are two countries. Well, probably three or four countries in Africa whose petroleum is huge. Angola, it's huge in petroleum, supplying America. You have Nigeria, huge in petroleum. Equatorial Guinea, huge in petroleum.
I mean,
and Libya,
huge. I mean, countries that are better than us, I'm comparing to us as a continent and as various countries, compared to what we have, you find that they probably have one thing, and they just take that and leverage it and make sure that they get maximum benefit out of that small competitive advantage compared to us who are spoiled for choice. You can go for it.
Well, it's called the resources curse. Because you have so many resources, you get lazy and you say they are going to work for me. Instead of saying, here are the resources I'm blessed. For others, they say we don't have any resources, but you know what? We have people. We're going to utilize these people. I think I may have told you a story. I went to Singapore sometime in 1999, and they say, what makes the port of Singapore the world's port of call? Is it because of our location? And they cover how strategic their location it is. Is it because of the investment in the infrastructure? They cover how many billions they have spent on the infrastructure. They cover a number of things, and they say, whilst all those are important, our competitive edge, our people make our location, make
hello.
Others.
I saw you from over here, and then I should come see. How are you doing?
It is so nice to see you.
Yeah, happy new year.
Hi, lady.
Oh, that's my colleague, Sharina.
Yes.
And the assistant. Yeah. We were up here seeing someone.
Oh,
sorry.
Hi.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Sia.
Mary,
one
nice
yes.
to meet you.
Well, keep well.
Yeah.
And I get a sense that you are growing from good to better.
Yes, I
get
the
same. I'm hearing that. Nice seeing you.
We'll keep it
okay,
back.
So. And so I think it's that. So for us, we have a wonderful country. In a sense, we are the center of the universe, but we are not utilizing it. If you look at from where we are to the east and to the west and to the north.
Yeah, wow.
But then your leadership generation will do better than...
We can only hope.
Yes.
The way I say it, I look at it, and the analogy that comes to mind when I think about us as Africa and our future, I almost see this moment as a final exam. You know, I really feel like if we get it wrong now, we would have lost it, like, for good.
I agree.
You know, I almost feel like this is our final exam, and we need to throw everything we've got and make sure we pass.
But if we don't, we are going to be colonized. And the next colonization is not going to be a political colonization. It's going to be economic colonization. And if it is economic colonization, they say, but you are free.
Mm.
You have the black president. You have the black cabinet. You have got the black
premier.
What more do you want, whereas you are in space?
I mean, someone I was talking to last week was telling me about how China has farms in Congo, I think, or another country, where they're actually, they're renting, they've got these long-term leases on these big chunks of land, growing their own food.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And I can already see a situation where our land won't belong to us, and people will be working for them in these fields, growing this food, and the food is leaving the continent, and if we want to have that food, they sell it back to us at a huge premium, and we die of hunger.
Yeah, but the prodigal son, he left home rich, and at some stage he was choosing between the pigs, and give this to the pigs, this I'm going to eat. We may end up being prodigal sons and daughters in our own continent, if we are not careful.
Wow.
So you're right, I think the idea of final exam, it needs to mobilize us to say, we have got no option. Winning is the only option for us.
Wow. Well, my last question really is an unscripted question. This is where I just ask you if during our conversation something has come up in your mind, or why you were coming here, planning in your head, you thought, hey, maybe this is something I need to tell Sia, especially if I didn't ask or touch it.
Mm.
Or, in simple terms, your last words.
I think one philosopher said, I shall pass but once in this world, and therefore any good I can do to anyone, let me do it now. Let me not postpone it and procrastinate, because I will not pass this world again.
Mm.
For us, I think, we need to, like John F. Kennedy, who understood, he had premonition that he's not going to live long. He had an extremely high sense of agency, extremely high. That's why when you talk about the vision, the discussion tends to almost be incomplete, except for those people who don't like Americans. But then John F. Kennedy, when he says, before the end of the century, we shall take the man to the moon, and back safely. He had that crisply clear vision, but also sense of agency. I think for us, we need to have a sense of agency.
Mm.
As you are saying, final exam. But you can't wait for final exam for 10 decades.
You can't.
You probably have no more than a decade.
That is so true. Wow, thank you so
much. I wish you all the best.
I really enjoyed our chat. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to chat to you about.